listener production.
Shares. Market. The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money.
Yep.
Our special. Special Sunday Mailbag Edition. I'm Scott Phillips, the Motley Fool's Chief Investment Officer, and I'm joined by Managing Director, Founder, and, at his insistence, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer of Strawman.com, Andrew Page. How are you, mate?
It takes up most of my time, the bottle washing and the cooking, I can tell you. So, yeah, I'm good, mate. How are you?
If you don't clean out the bottles, mate, then they get bacteria in them. You've got to make sure the bottles are sterilised. Rule number one.
I have brewed my own beer in the past, so I know all about sterilising bottles.
Can I tell you, one of my great regrets is my old man's unfortunately no longer with us, and he took his homebrew recipes with him. So I found a super old one that Mum had somewhere, which I'm sure was like a, you know, generation one recipe of, frankly, he brewed a lot of beer. We had, I know you're not supposed to take milk crates, but he had, I want to say about 20 milk crates in the garage, and he'd rotate the beer. So he'd brew it, then he'd leave it sitting there, and he'd kind of go first in, first out. He'd rotate the stock. It was an operation.
It's a science. It is. Yeah,
exactly. So I'll get some tips from you. This is not the homebrew show. Should we do a homebrew? No, we don't do a homebrew.
No.
It'd be a good excuse for a drink though, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Not sure how well it goes on a podcast. Oh, nice beer. Anyway, maybe that's our after. Maybe. What do you reckon Motley Fool Money After Dark? Do you reckon it's got legs?
I just think there's probably, if we look, there's probably about 4,000 different individual homebrew podcasts that are out there, and it's going to be hard carving out a niche, as the Americans say.
Exactly. Is there a hobbyist bigger than the homebrew hobby? I don't know what else there would be, but homebrew hobbyists are a special group of people, right? Is there a big? What else would there be more podcasts on? They're like kind of home hobby things.
Oh, geez, I don't know. Hey, this is the beauty of these kinds of platforms, that you can go as niche as you like, and there's always something. There's something on anything that you can conceive of, and if there isn't, you should create a podcast on that, because that niche will probably be filled pretty quickly.
What you're saying is two random schmucks can just start a podcast and chat to themselves for an hour a week on something like this.
Well, we're proof positive that it doesn't take a lot of talent or charisma or any of those.
Thank God. I do wonder why people listen, but I you know what? If this is as bad as your week gets, then well done. Maybe we're here to give everyone else a baseline. I'm not entirely sure. Anyway, let's move on, mate.
Let's answer some questions.
Yeah, let's do that. Much more interesting than our rambling. All right, here we go. One from Lucas. Hi, Scott. I love the podcast. I'm a regular listener of all three each week. Man, that's well done. Thanks, Lucas. You should be four, Lucas. What about the good oil? Mate, come on. Help me out here. I've got to mention it at least a couple of times an episode. It's contractual. No, it's not really, but it's ego, really. Anyway, he says, my question for the mailbag is simply, how do you and Andrew find new companies to invest in? And then he says, opportunity for free plug for ShareAdvisor, of which I'm a member. Thank you. I appreciate it, Lucas. And I'm going to speculate. Andrew might mention Strawman once or twice in this answer, but I'll ask him first. Strawman, what is Strawman though, before we do that, just to make sure
we are a private investment club, and you know damn well what we are, my friend. Boring. You know very well what we are.
You give me a grip. I'm giving you a free plug here, dude. Be kind. All right. let's start. Other than strawman.com, how do you find new ideas to invest in, mate?
So there's it is a thorny problem because there are 2,000 something stocks on the ASX. Mm-hmm. And, well, historically, statistically, most of them are rubbish. Like, you just know, you look over any period of time. We mentioned this on Friday's podcast. You know, most of the gains from the market, quote unquote, the market, is driven by a very small subset of companies. So it's hard. And as I've always said, you know, you have to be unashamedly biased when it comes to your portfolio, right? You want to have, you probably don't want more than 15 or 20 companies in there, because it gives you all the benefits of diversification. And then it's just about finding the best 15, 20 companies you can on the market. Mm-hmm. So there's plenty of there's plenty of very decent, respectable companies I'm happy just not to go near, not because there's anything wrong with them, just because I think there's better. And I've heard people mention it in the past, it's like managing a football team.
I like that.
Yeah, you just want to put your best players on the pitch at any one. Nice. That list will change, and the rest of it. So anyway, this is all just a big run up to sort of say that you want to be very fussy, and and if you are going to be very fussy, there's a lot of stuff to go through. So some people will advocate things like stock screening tools, and they're a dime a dozen. They're out there. You just sort of say, show me a company with a market cap more than this and a dividend yield more than that, and whatever thousands of metrics you want to throw at it. And it's actually a really great tool, because it just gets, if you say, look, I'm not interested in gold miners, what do you just filter them all out. Yeah. So it reduces that short list really, really, really easily. Yeah. The trouble with these filters is that there's as I've gotten older and a bit more experienced with investing, the more I'm realizing that the real wisdom is found in a lot of the intangible. It's really found in the subjective in a lot of ways. So there's plenty of companies out there that might have really, really high debt, but it's absolutely appropriate for their business model and is perfectly fine. There's companies out there that might have very low return on equities, but that's characteristic of an anomalous one-off accounting treatment in a particular year, blah, 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 blah. So these fundamental ratios are really great, but they do hide a lot of context and a lot of detail behind it. So I think you'll often find some really great companies that way, but you will also miss a lot. So as I've gotten older, I actually find that it is just a lot of reading. The great thing with this game is the more that you do it, the more you sort of build up a knowledge base. So I don't have to look at some companies again from scratch because I'm already broadly familiar with them. Yeah. And you can build, even if it's a different company, you might be familiar or have done some work in that sector or that industry before. So it all builds on itself. But these days, it's just a lot of reading. Oh, what does this company do? Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if they're making any money. Oh, they are. Oh, are they making any more than last year? Oh, they're growing really, really well. What's their balance sheet like? And you just sort of go through the process and you get to be quicker and quicker and quicker at it. And really, your job as an investor is to say no. So you want it to be a quick process so you can go, nah, nah, nah. It's a very exceptional company that has to be let into your illustrious sort of team that you're going to field. But that's how I do it. I don't think you need to be super advanced. I just think you need to be well-read and put the time in. Obviously, sign up to Motley Fool and Strawman because that's what we're in the business of doing,
clearly,
right?
Clearly.
We put ideas out there, but own those ideas, you know? Get into them, understand them for yourself. And unfortunately, with all of this stuff, it'd be lovely just to have a bit of software or press a button and just sort of like spat it all out, but it's just not that easy. And if ever it gets that easy and it works, we're all in trouble because we'll all just get exactly the same return because everything's perfectly known and priced in.
So I'm going to ask you the same question again. If you were, not you, but Lucas, and you were getting started, can you kind of take your own mind back the 40
years? Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah,
okay.
Sorry.
No.
It's all about me, mate.
You answered the right question because that's what you were asked. I'm going to ask you a different question, which is just if you didn't know what you knew now, you know, the as you say, what I love about investing, frankly, being an old bloke, is the benefit of accumulated knowledge, right? To your point, we can draw on 20 years plus of heuristics and lessons and pattern recognition that I didn't have as a 21-year-old or a 23-year-old when I bought my first stock, right? And frankly, I made a lot of mistakes. Yeah. I don't know what I'm going to say. I'm asking you to answer another question so I can think about it while I do. But if you were Lucas and you were like, okay, I got my first $1,000.
Yeah.
Now, where do I put
Where do I start? Okay, great question. Great question. I would actually go back a step from there as well. And I'd sort of say, well, what am I looking for? I mean, before you start looking, I mean, it sounds really obvious, but you have to know what you're looking for.
Yeah, true.
And specifically, I'm talking about, well, what are some of the characteristics you want? Are you someone who is really keen on getting great dividends? Are you someone who's really interested in fast growth? Are you someone who has a particular inside advantage because you've worked in a particular industry? or even go back a step further and ask yourself, well, what are the kind of characteristics I should be looking for? Like reliability of earnings is a good thing and, you know, not too much debt. That's probably a nice thing as well. I guess I probably want, if I'm going to buy a part stake in a business, I guess I want the people running it to be pretty honest and capable. Here's the big one. Do I understand what the hell they do? And that sounds really condescending, but I'll put my hand up. There's plenty of stocks that come across my desk. I just don't get it. Say a phrase that they work in, I don't know, the machine language for breast density imaging or something like that. But do I really understand how that works as a business model?
Right.
And how do they actually? Who are their customers? Yes. Who do they sell to? What are the levers of growth here? What can I have? Assuming I've got any ability to grasp exactly what they do and some kind of insight into how that business works. Have I got any lens on what that might look like in the future and how that's going to unfold? Like really, the thing I love about investing is that you can just always draw it back to first principles. You can always draw it back to the basics. And just keep it ask the questions that feel simple. Ask the questions that the professionals are too embarrassed to ask because they feel as though you should know that type thing.
Yeah.
I've been in many of shows and other things with other people, and there's just lots of big words used, and I've been in a host situation a number of times. You kind of press on some of those things, and it's like you feel. Yeah. You don't know what you're talking about. I don't either, but clearly you don't grasp it. There is something elegant, I find, with simplicity. And when
I like that a lot.
I've always said with investing, there's no extra points for degree of difficulty here. And mm-hmm. I probably stole that off you at some point.
You did, yeah.
I
probably stole it from someone else, so it's all good.
it's a great saying though, you know. Einstein. I need things that I can wrap my brain around. I understand mm-hmm. I feel as though I could have a reasonably cogent, half intelligent conversation with the CEO if we were at a barbecue and I was saying, "Hey, how's business going? What are you up to?"
Yeah.
I feel as though that's a really, really great filter. And I guess I've really walked back from the original question, but that's it. Just keep going.
That's good.
But why?
That's good.
Yep. But why? Yep. But why? And you just keep going back. Now, most of the time you'll hit these roadblocks. It just starts to get beyond me, and that's fine. Chuck it in the bin and keep looking. If it sounds like what I'm saying to answer this question is very work heavy, it is. I think it's also fascinating. I think for the intellectually curious, mm-hmm. it's actually really great because it goes beyond just the share market. I mean, these are businesses operating in society. It's fascinating. Some of the technologies that they're working with. And if you are listening to this and going, "Oh my God, I would rather watch paint dry," I actually totally respect that point of view. That's cool too. Buy an ETF, right? Like you're cool. But if you are the person who said, "No, I want to be a stock picker. I want to pick stocks," well, make sure you enjoy that because otherwise you're just setting yourself up for an exercise in frustration and pain.
Yep.
And then if you do, you'll find that it isn't actually too much work. It's actually enjoyable. Right. And as you said before, you accumulate and build and compound all of that knowledge. And so it becomes quicker and quicker and quicker. But unfortunately, there's no shortcuts. So try and stand on the shoulders of giants, you know, subscribe to Motley Fool Share Advisor. You know, you might not agree with everything. You might not understand some of the things there, but at least you know that you're getting, I've always called it a target rich environment. You're going to make plenty of mistakes, but there's going to be plenty of good ones in there too.
Is that from playing too many aeroplane computer games as a kid?
As a kid, last weekend. Do you mean?
I've seen your gaming rig. I know you're still when you pretend you're in there building the strawman business. I'm not entirely sure you're not. I may have a chat with your lovely wife.
Someone's keeping the universe safe one day at a time, my friend.
I'm not going to add anything to what you said, mate. You've done a great job, with the exception of simply saying, "I'm going to repeat your point about keeping it simple, Lucas." Start with stuff you really know well, and honestly, don't try and hit it out of the park early. Start accumulating knowledge. So I would actually, mate, if it was me, start with stuff you know better than the other stuff. Know you're going to make mistakes. Commit to keep going, and just press on. Whenever you make a mistake, learn from it. You will make plenty. Andrew still makes plenty. I still make even more. Just keep learning.
Yeah. All right. I mean, everyone understands how Woolies works, right? You know, there's a spectrum out there, and some stuff is more easy to wrap your head around than others.
A question from a regular correspondent, one of my favourites simply because of his chosen screen name, which is Rick Disneck, which I mentioned before. For those who are 12th Man fans back from when I was a kid, you will appreciate the screen name. I'm sure it's not his actual name, but Rick, thank you. He just simply says, "Hi, Scott. I'm listening to last Sunday's podcast and the comments about Blackmores. Do you think a lack of cold and flu season due to COVID has also affected local sales?" And I just asked a question. The answer is yes. And I just raise it because Rick makes a really good point, something I didn't mention last week. Blackmores does a really booming cold and flu business. Mm. And there's no cold and flu because we're all stuck inside. Can I tell you, I had the healthiest winter I've ever had. I know plenty of people cook with COVID. And I don't mean that to, you know, almost as a bit callous to say it. But the reality, we were inside. My son, my wife, we had the healthiest 12 months we've ever had just because we weren't mixing with people, which is weird in itself. I'm not sure I'd choose it. I'd happily take a couple of colds to be able to go and have a beer or two and go and watch a footy or something. But I do think it has an impact. I don't think it's the major impact. I think the Daigou sales are the biggest part. But absolutely, yeah, people simply weren't buying as much. I'm sure it probably COVID actually helped as well because people were interested in taking more vitamins to try and prevent getting crook. It's probably part of it, or boost their immune system or whatever else they think Blackmores can be used for is useful. So I'm sure it's a bit of both, but yeah, I'm sure that's right, Rick.
Does Blackmores sell horse dewormer tablets? while we're talking about COVID cures?
I was going to say, if not, they should, but I don't actually want to say that. Can I tell you? It drives me. Here you go. Just for the sake of...
I lured you in there, didn't I? Yeah.
Just for the sake of offending at least a few of our listeners, apparently the Craig Kelly texts actually link to a fake website. with debunked evidence, if you can believe that. So there you go.
Fantastic.
Don't take horse tablets, people. Go and talk to your doctor, and if they recommend it, get vaccinated. All right, Jonathan says, I'm just listening to Friday's podcast. This is last Friday's. The unluckiest bastard in the world theory, which I said, you know, if you only bought at the top, you'd be the unluckiest bastard in the world. The unluckiest bastard in the world theory has been broken down by Brandon from the Young Investors podcast. Some data I think people would love and maybe a potential special guest for us kids. Thank you, Jonathan, you smug so-and-so. Just because you're young, mate, don't rub my face in it. He says, apparently 77% gain over 20 years or 3.1% per annum if you only invest at every market peak before a crash. Not great, but still better than you'd think. So there you go. Nice work, Brandon. I don't know that podcast. I'll check it out. I just thought that was kind of cool. So, you know, I said, look, if you bought at the top, then of course, you know, only looking at the top is a waste of time because you can invest and you should be investing regularly through all market cycles. Jonathan just sharing that Brandon's done the work and apparently it's a 3.1% gain per annum even if you bought at the top. So there you go. That's still it's a reminder that even the unluckiest bastard in the world can make money investing.
Yeah, yeah. That time heals all wounds. There's this great chart. There's a couple of great charts that prove the point. There's one, it's a really nice one, and what it does is it plots the variation in returns on the market over every 1 year period since day dot. So, you know, all the way back to the Melbourne Exchange in 1905 or something. And you get like on 1 year, I think it was 60% was the best return. On 1 year, it was, you know, 50% down or something like that. So there's this huge bar. And then they go to three. So the next thing on the chart is a 3 year period. So let's look at every 3 year window over that exact same time frame. There's less of them, but they're longer. Those bars shrink, so you don't get as good a return at the top, but not at the bottom. And anyway, you continue along with that exercise. Once you get to 10 years, and if you're factoring in dividends, as you rightly should, there's actually no negative period in history for the Australian share market. So in other words, it was impossible. You could go back in a time machine, and it's impossible to lose money. At a broad index level, there's definitely stocks that are exception to the rule there. And adjusting for dividends, it is just a very, very, very powerful thing. And I've often said too, it is your greatest advantage, I think, as a retail investor in this hyper-competitive world that we now live in, when all of the money and infrastructure and assets and resources are going sort of into those shorter-term endeavors. That is where your edge lies. And that's why you should be focused there anyway. It's just really hard to go wrong.
There you go. Nicely done. Mate, I have to take you to task on David's behalf.
Oh, no.
David asked a question, which I don't think it's a question. I think it's a statement. But he poses it with a question mark, so I'll ask it appropriately. Why do people think that Mr. Pennybags from the Monopoly game? Why do they think he?
I know what he's going to say. A monocle. I know. I've had 10 people.
He does not have any
eyewear,
says David. Slap Rampage into consciousness.
Yeah.
Here's a virtual slap from me to you via David Ram. You've. I don't know why you think he has a monocle. I probably agree with you at the time, but given he's pointed you out as the troublemaker, I'm going to stick with David.
So it's a great point, Jason. They've done some studies on it, and it is one of those things that everyone assumes he has money and he doesn't, and they don't know where it comes from. So I've actually had a bunch of people go, did you know? So now I know. Apologies for that. No monocle.
There you go. It's all good. All right, here we go. Now we get into the questions. Oh dear. No, we've talked about this before. This is from Matt. This question is aimed for you, Scott. Oh dear. I really enjoy your thoughts on investing, but you know, it's always nice when people give you a compliment before telling you you're an idiot, isn't it? But I still haven't understood your view on ethical investing. All right. Firstly, I used to think that big business on the stock market focused too much on profits, which led them to do unethical things like destroy the environment or pay people too little, unless you're a CEO. However, when I found out, it was my bracket's not his. However, when I found out about ethical ETFs, I realized I could invest in a way that met my views. Without ethical ETFs, I would be left with picking single stocks for my whole portfolio, which I don't have the time nor expertise to do. I know you hate greenwashing, and so do I. The first ethical fund I found had Rio Tinto as a holding. Not long after that, is the Juukan Gorge?
What a tragedy.
Cave incident. Mm. So I steered clear of that. Also, I know you said that people would be better off investing normally and donating the money, but that does not sound like a good way to compound wealth, and I don't want anything to do with Exxon. Anyway, in your view, if someone has done the research, was happy with the holdings of ETF so they can sleep at night, and it helped them get into the market, is that not worth paying 0.59% in fees? I hope this question isn't too long for your show, and I look forward to hearing your response. Regards, Matt. Matt, if So the answer is, well, it depends where you ask. Is someone say, is it not worth paying? Yes, it's worth paying if it does all those things you say. If it makes you, if you can sleep at night and it gets you in the market and you are going to compound more wealth than not doing it, then yes, of course, it's absolutely worth it. I have no issue with people who choose to do to invest. I will say so-called ethically. I don't mean that directed at you, but in general. I have absolutely no dramas with that. If you, you know, there are businesses I own and don't own. There are businesses you own or don't own. If you want to apply an ethical filter, go for it. I have no problem with you doing that at all. My challenge is that I would argue your 0.59% is making a fund manager rich, paying for some analysts, and I'm sure they appreciate the business, but it's not making a single skerrick of difference to the environment in your case or the world in terms of you mentioned destroying the environment, paying people too little. If you sell BA, if you don't own Rio, but I do, I don't, by the way, but if I did, Rio would still have destroyed Juukan Gorge because they're Rio and that's what they did, regardless of who owned it, right? So you could feel good that you don't own it when it happens. You feel good about not owning Exxon, the oil company, and that's fine. But they'll do what they're going to do anyway, no matter who owns it. And so you're paying 0.59% to have no impact. And I don't say that as a criticism at all, or even to be a smart aleck. But the reality is the same number of Exxon shares exist, no matter who holds them. I don't mind you not owning them. My biggest issue is that I think a whole lot of ethical funds are making a whole lot of money from people who are, and maybe even that money is not even extortionate. Maybe it's not even greenwashing. I don't know what fund it is, by the way, which is nice. So I can't be sued for libel. Maybe the fees are reasonable in the sense that they put a whole lot of work and they spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in analysts' time, effort, energy to go and find those companies. So I'm not even saying it's necessarily the company themselves are profiteering. They possibly are. Maybe they are. They probably are, but they may not be. My argument is simply that you're paying 0.59% to actually not make a difference at all. If you want to pay 0.59 to make a difference, an actual difference, then I'd say go for it. So look, but to your very, very clear question, Matt, if you can sleep at night, if you don't want to own those companies and you're happy to pay 0.6%, then go for it, for sure. No, I have no issue. If you choose to, as long as you do it with your eyes open, my only argument the whole way through has been you could buy... you can invest in an ETF for 0.04% or 0.1%, so effectively dropping your fees by somewhere between 10 and 15 times, 5 or 10 times, just by simply saying, I know that I own those companies and if I don't, someone else is going to anyway. And so that's just the market that I'm in. That's the scenario that I'm in. You're paying a fee to sleep at night and, again, that's fine. But just know that you're not making an actual impact. You're not changing anything. In my view, Andrew has a slightly different view, and I'll let him have his say. I don't reckon you're changing a single thing by doing it. So, but if you want to, like again, I won't criticize you for it. I have a criticism reserved for other people, including the funds that charge too much. But I've said before, shares in Australian Ethical Investments, the company, because I think people like you will do that, Matt, and I appreciate you want to. And does that make me hypocritical? Not really, because I'm happy to say both at the same time. I don't think you should, but I know people are going to, and I'm happy to own the business that makes money from those people. But the reality is it just makes like literally zero difference at an ETF level in particular, in my view. So I don't think it's worth paying. I wouldn't pay the fees. I think you're reducing your returns unnecessarily because you're not getting anything for the extra money you're paying.
Mm.
That's pretty polemic for me, mate. What do you think? Do you want to have a different view or moderate my view?
Look, it's just I totally see where you're coming from. It doesn't change things short term. It doesn't change things at all in a lot of ways. But my argument is that at enough when it becomes enough of a factor where it for enough people. It has real world implications on the multiples that companies trade at and therefore their cost of capital. So there is that cost. If there's a business that's entirely self-funded and never needs to pass the hat around amongst shareholders, then yeah, there's nothing that you can really
literally
do.
Yeah. Yep.
But when you're and most businesses, well, a lot of businesses, yeah, probably most businesses on the ASX do raise money from the markets from time to time. And if they've got a very low multiple because the market sees them as unpalatable for environmental, social, governance reasons or whatever it happens to be, that's a real impost on them. And it also impacts other people's other capital allocation decisions from people who are making these big decisions who will avoid and favour certain things. So it will play out over time. I guess I would say it like this. It's sort of, let's say I just stop recycling my cardboard tomorrow. Yep. Does that make any difference to the climate? Like, absolutely not. It does nothing if I decide or do or to not do it. But if enough of us do it, then it does have an impact. So it is a collective action problem to a degree. It is a problem that would take time to sort of manifest itself. But I think it's I don't fault people for doing it, particularly. Yes, and I've said before as well, I don't think it needs to be a compromise. I think if you're paying a little bit extra, but you're getting a better performance as a result of it, you can invest ethically and make a lot of good money. Then why not? Yep. So it's just a personal choice. I guess it's easy to get into a debate with all of this stuff, but there's a company that you don't like what they're doing, don't invest in it. And there's I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
I agree. You know, can I just take the cost of capital thing, though, just because I want to be an argumentative so-and-so. I'll say bastard because I said bastard already. I want to be an argumentative bastard. Let's say it increases the cost of capital, right? And let's say it decreases profitability. Does Exxon actually drill any less oil because the share price is half or because their cost of capital goes up by 25%? I guess my argument is still that even if it changes the financial returns of the business, it's like Exxon goes, good point, we'll go into puppy farming instead. Like, they're just, you know, they're just not going to. So my view is still that even if those metrics are right, and even if you get the kind of the schadenfreude or the whatever you must say, you bastard, I suck it to you, now your PE is half what it used to be, you bastard, you deserve it. It's like, we're still going to drill as much oil, we're still going to burn as much coal, we're still going to, you know, like I think-
As long as we're viable, we're going to keep doing what we do.
And right. So that's my general point. I think, and this is, Matt, I know it's about investing the difference or giving the difference to charity. You're right. It doesn't actually compound it. But you know, frankly, if you wanted to, for example, I would, if it was me and I wanted to have an impact, I would pay 0.1 instead of 0.59 and then take the difference and donate to the charity. If you want to give away the extra fees you're paying to Greenpeace or Worldwide Fund for Nature, or I don't know what charities people like or don't like, and who I'm setting off by mentioning individual charities. I assume they're both decent charities, but do your own thing. I honestly think, Matt, if you've got any effort for this, I would seriously encourage you. Like, for all of my skepticism about investing, I would seriously encourage you. Your point about recycling, Ram, be a conscious consumer. Mm. Like, we can have 1,000 times as much benefit. Go and buy the stuff that's made from recycled. You know, we buy recycled toilet paper at home, right? And it's more expensive, but we do it specifically because it's saving a bit of virgin forest. Go and shop at retailers who commit to using renewable energy at 100% for all of their stuff, or who donate their food waste to charity, or to, you know, like there are really, really great, and banking. You mentioned cost of capital, Ram. Mm. The very best thing we can do, honestly, is campaign against our banks to say, don't lend money to people destroying the environment. That's 1,000,000% more effective. And again, I'm not saying it doesn't have to be either or. I've got lots of energy for that sort of stuff. Like, I'm not an anti-climate change guy. I'm not I'm not someone who, you know, I wish it was true. I desperately wish, if I thought ethical investing worked, I would have my whole portfolio in it tomorrow, like literally tomorrow. If I think it could have an impact on particularly the environment, but all other things like, you know, as you say, Matt, things like wages and other things. I think if we could do it, we should. I think our value as conscious consumers is just phenomenally huge, bigger than most people expect. Even to your point, Ram, it doesn't take that many bank customers who say, hey, Westpac, stick it up your jumper if you're going to fund logging. And guess what? Guns, the timber mill, went broke in Tasmania because all the banks said, oh, we're not touching that. That's too tight. That's too hot. That works. It works really, really, really well.
I just think it still works in the other way as well. If again, people who are allocating vast sums of capital are looking at it just saying, geez, Christ, we can't really raise much money over in this space over here. Here's another space that people feel really good about. It's much sort of cheaper to do and much more productive. And it just over time, I think at a scale where there's enough people thinking about it and it has real world impacts. Yeah, Exxon's going to keep doing what it's going to do, but maybe the next startup is maybe not going to go into oil recognizing the higher costs of capital and all of that other kind of stuff. So it's...
Yep.
You know, it's one of those things. If you were sitting here saying, look, here's your choice, Andrew, make 10% a year but not worry about ethical investing, or make 8% a year and worry about it, that's a more difficult question. But if I can make 10% a year and still do good, then why not? That's a cost-free way of doing something good that makes you feel good. So I'm all for it.
There you go.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
A question from Rita, mate. Hi, Scott and Andrew. I've been enjoying your recent and back catalogue of podcasts during my daily lockdown walks in Victoria. Man, I wish we could get you because you wanted to listen to us, Rita, not just because you're locked down, but I'm glad we can accompany you, at least keep you occupied and entertained. I am no stranger to stock market plunges, but I'm grateful to you, Scott, for your weekly emails during last year's pandemic correction, urging readers to stay the course or invest more if we had the means, which my husband and I did. Nice work. Nevertheless, she says, it's alarming to see stock prices continue to drop further over months and years as we experienced in 2001, 2007 and beyond. Different question. My question to you relates to the fairness of franking credits, which still divides many people. As per an article by John Calquin on the fairness of franking credits in First Links. I won't go into the link. There's a link there if you want to look. Just search John Calquin, K-A-L-K-M-A-N, on the fairness of franking credits in First Links of August 26. In light of the large numbers of young people who have taken to stock market investing in the last 17 months, do you personally believe that franking credits are fair and should be refunded to people on tax-free incomes, man, e.g. retirees and SMSFs, or some stay-at-home parents, students, etc., who receive no welfare but may be financially supported by a partner or parents? There you go. The question was from me, Andrew. I'm going to ask you to answer it first. Are franking credit refunds fair?
I think they are. I think the ability to claim back excess ones maybe is a little bit of a bridge too far. But let's pan right out here. All it's doing is actually a very fair system, and it just says we're not going to double tax the same source of income. So if a company makes money and pays tax on that and then distributes it to you as an owner, having already had 30% tax taken out, it just says, well, you pay the difference. And I think that's actually pretty fair. That we do the same kind of thing elsewhere. So it's not something that's unique to shares. Mm-hmm. I think that's just a very favorable thing. I think it's a positive structural thing for the economy. Mm-hmm. Claiming it back, I get the argument as to why you should be able to, because again, you've overpaid. Well, the entity mm-hmm. that you own mm-hmm. has overpaid, and it's what it's getting a little thing back. I guess where I find it less palatable is that just generally when you look at it pragmatically, it's like, well, the people who this is really meaningful for are people who are generally pretty wealthy. And are we as a system giving tax advantages to people who are probably the least likely to need them the most?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But in terms of putting that stuff aside, in terms of mm-hmm. just the accounting of the system, I think it's mm-hmm. fair. Giving additional benefits to the wealthy that others don't get to participate in is probably less so.
Nice. I like it, mate. I'm going to direct Rita and anyone who wants to listen. This is dating. It's dated, but it's also still current. There's an article I wrote called Why Bill Shorten, remember him as leader of the opposition? Why Bill Shorten is right and wrong on dividends, I think I called it. I mean, franking. Let me double check that while I do it. So I completely agree with you, Andrew. With a little bit of a different angle. So to your point, here's the thing. If you line up three people, right? Someone who gets cash, who's got cash in the bank and gets interest. Someone who owns an investment property and gets rent. And someone who owns shares in a company and gets dividends.
Mm.
Each of those three people get $1,000 a year from their investment assets.
Mm-hmm.
The $1,000 you get from bank interest, you've got to have a squillion dollars to get $1,000 these days in bank interest, but let's assume it's possible. Gets $1,000 and pays tax at their marginal rate. Let's say their marginal rate for the fun of it is 30%. Mm-hmm. Right? So they get their $1,000 and they pay their $30 or $300, and they get $700 left over. The person who owns a rental property does exactly the same thing. $1,000 in rent, $30, $70 left, $700 left over. The person who gets the money from dividends is getting $1,000, but that $1,000 has already had tax paid on it by the company. In fact, that was probably closer to $1,400 that the company earned. That it paid 30% tax on, it was $1,000 left over. And then the shareholder would have to pay another 30% on top of that, meaning that when they get their $700 after that, there's effectively been a 50% tax levied on the profits made by the company.
Mm.
And so that is why franking credits were introduced. And by the way, by a Labor Prime Minister or Treasurer anyway, Hawken Keating, way back in the day, because it is double taxation, right? It effectively, if rather than $1,000 of dividends, if a company earned $1,000 in profit, he pays a tax of $700. That's all you get as a shareholder.
Mm.
And then you pay tax on that. And you think, well, how is it fair that income is taxed once from interest, it's taxed once from rent, but it's taxed twice when it comes to company profits? Mm. And that's why I think the franking system is particularly fair. I think it's appropriate. The reality is that company is just a holding structure. The other way to look at it is if you own the assets yourselves directly, you wouldn't pay a higher tax rate just because you said PTY LTD at the end of the name of the business. Mm. Conversely, if I own a rental property, in a company name, I'd pay tax twice on it, but it's owning it personally. It shows you the silliness of having to pay tax twice just because there's PTY LTD at the end of the company.
Mm.
And that's for me why I think franking is really, really fair. I actually also think, by the way, that franking refunds are entirely fair and entirely appropriate. But and this is why I said Shorten is right and wrong on dividends. He is what he was identifying was the fact that, for example, if you're in super, if you get if you've got BHP shares and they pay their 30% tax, and your tax rate is zero, you get a refund for all the tax BHP's paid. So effectively, BHP and you, between the two of you, pay no tax on that profit. Commonwealth Bank would pay no tax on that profit. If Woolies was owned entirely by people in super funds, Woolies would never pay a cent in corporate tax. And I don't think anyone thinks that's fair, particularly if, as you say, Ram, that the super fund members are squillionaires.
Yeah.
What I would do absolutely and do it tomorrow is I would change the taxation of super and retirement incomes to be progressive rather than a flat rate of 0 or 15%
in 100%. Yep.
So I think that's why I say is right and wrong. Bill Shorten was right to say this is not sustainable. And I don't say he's right or wrong across the board or that I would have voted for him or not voted for him. It's not a political thing. The policy, they identified the right problem. The solution was, I think, a terrible solution. I think they got hung with their own petard trying to do it, because the issue was never about franking. The issue was, because here's the thing, if I'm on welfare and I get a dollar in interest or a dollar in rent or a dollar in dividends, why should I pay more on it just because it's shares rather than rent? It makes zero sense, right? Now, if you're on welfare, you're probably not going to get that, but just to use an extreme example. Equally, if I'm in super, should I get frank credits free and rent free and interest cash income free, interest free? No, of course I shouldn't. I should pay, because if I've got $1 squillion in super, I should be paying more than 0% just because inside super. And that does absolutely dilute the system, and it frankly perverts the system.
It's a perversion of the system.
Yeah, it is. The whole
structure was set up to enable people to very effectively save for their retirement. It wasn't set up as a tax haven for the rich.
Correct.
That's but if it's kind of what the way you do it though, right? So it's sort of perversion is the right word.
Yeah. So the article is called "Why Bill Shorten is Wrong and Right on Dividends." I wrote it on March 16, 2018, it's now 3 years old, but it actually goes through the theory of why I think it's wrong and the solution I would suggest, which is progressive taxation of super higher than the pensions, and not the personal income tax rates, go above the pension, because there's got to be some incentive for saving and putting money aside and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but dude, when you've got $20 million, you don't need any further incentive to...
I think it's reasonable to tax that. And taxing it at zero because it happens to be called super is, as you say, a perversion. Let's move on. We've done enough of that. Hi, Scott. Can you please tell me how you calculate the dividend yield in your recommendations? All right. We're not going to go into a lot of this because this is very specific. But he basically wants, sorry, this is from Patricia, she wants to go into basically how it should be calculated. And Patricia talks about, to calculate the yield on your capital at the time you invested, I think you would need to take the dividend per share, divided by the value of shares on the day of purchase, which I think is also right. So she says GPT price today, $4.76, dividend per share is 13.3 cents, therefore, do the maths, 2.8%. Absolutely right. And then she says, whereas on the ComSec website, using their formula, it shows the yield is 4.9%, which is quite misleading if one is trying to get the best return on investment. I look forward to your comments. Kind regards, Patricia. So lots of details, mate, lots of questions, but let's break it down. There is very different ways of thinking about dividend yield.
Yeah.
First one I want to talk to you about, I suppose, is do you take the forward yield, the previous yield, or as ComSec does, blend the two?
I don't overthink it.
Cool.
For most companies, there's not going to be a material gain. It's not like it's going to go from, $0.40 payout 1 year to $3.80 the next year. It's not going to be a difference. But here's the trade-off. Mm-hmm. There's always a trade-off. Forward-looking yields are much more appropriate because I don't get last year's dividend. If I buy today, I only get future dividends. So using last year's dividend is just completely irrelevant.
Yep.
So it's got that advantage if you're looking forward. The trouble is when you're looking forward, all of a sudden you're dealing with a guess. You might want to call it a forecast because it makes you sound smarter, but you're totally dealing with a guess. Now, on the flip side, historical, 100% mathematically accurate. You can't argue. This is what happened. This is the dividend they paid. But there's no guarantee that dividend will be paid again. In fact, if ever you see a very unusual yield on the market, I was talking about doing scans before. If you do a scan for a dividend yield more than 10%, you'll actually find a bunch of results. Would you, as an investor, be reasonable in expecting a 10% yield for those investments? No, you wouldn't be, because the market's not that dumb where it's going to leave a 10% yield just sitting there in plain sight with no one interested in doing it. It's because no one expects the dividend to be maintained, and therefore it's a spurious kind of yield figure. So I think what you want to try and do is just sort of look through all of that. And the question you need to really be asking is, well, it's about the kind of dividend that I think these guys are able to pay, and roughly what kind of growth can I expect in that dividend, and keep it and base your calculations on that.
Love it, mate. Great answer. I can't add much to that. One thing you may have done is potentially use the last dividend rather than the last 12 months of dividends. So I don't know in the example of GPT, but my guess is if you took the last dividend, so remember companies pay dividends twice a year. And if someone said to you, hey, how much do you earn? And you said, oh, I earned $5,000 because I got paid $5,000 last month. They said, well, but how much do you earn per year? What's the total amount on some sort of rolling basis? Because we're looking at when you do any dividend or any interest income, anything else, there's little two letters after the percentage are per annum. And so you want to be comparing apples for apples.
Yeah, I can confirm that it is just the interim dividend.
There you go. So that might be the other thing, Patricia, is make sure you grab both of those, add them together. It's a very good chance if you add the GPT together, it probably is closer to 4.9% for that reason. So I don't think it is misleading because, well, unless you're looking for a six-month yield, but then you've got to recognize they're all lower than that. And again, we're all conditioned. I think there's no reason to say we have to look at income on a yearly basis. A trip around the sun doesn't mean anything, but it just helps us get a common basis for those conversations. We do interest in the bank per annum, rental yields calculated generally per annum. So I think it's a reasonable basis. So make sure you add them both together and then do the maths. CommSec's website does tend to blend the past and the future estimates together where they've got estimates from another analyst or something else. Be a little bit careful with that because the analyst could simply be wrong. But as Andrew said, there's no perfect solution because you don't get the last dividend, and it might be great, it might be very useless, or it might be somewhere in between. Banks are a great example, by the way. The banks over the last 12 months actually had their dividends cut because APRA said they had to. So it's very likely the future dividends for the banks are actually larger than the trailing dividends because they now get to pay out full dividends again. So that's one example you might want to be careful you don't overdo it. On the flip side, plenty of retailers and plenty of Fortescue paid a 10% dividend.
Actually,
this blows my mind, right?
Yeah.
10% dividend like a week ago,
yeah.
2 weeks ago, because it made $1 squillion because iron ore was $220 a ton. Yeah. Now it's $130 a ton now. So guess what? That dividend is absolutely not sustainable. But they paid it out because they should, and that's right. So just be a little bit cautious on that one.
One thing I'll add, which is not the question, but related to it, is I've heard people before say, oh, yes, I know that if I look up the yield of Commonwealth Bank, it says 3.6%. But, that's because shares are at $100. I bought shares at $50. So my yield is 7.2%. So I just take the dividend that I got or I'm expecting to get and divide it, not by the last traded price, I divide it by my price because that's the yield that's relevant to me. Which kind of sounds pretty reasonable, but I think...
Doesn't it?
It does. And I remember long ago I was making that argument. I said, well, that's what matters to me. That's my yield. And it's really not appropriate because regardless of what you bought your shares for, the fact is the Commonwealth Bank shares today, the market's happy to buy them for $100 off you. And you could press a button and turn that into cash and press another button and turn it into gold or crypto or a million other kind of things. You have $100 now. Yep. Is it in monetary form? No, it's in equity form. But that's what you've got. And the yield that you're getting on the equity the capital that you've got is 3.6%. A lot of bad investment decisions get made by people anchoring to their purchase price. In fact, banks are a great example here where I've spoken to a lot of people in the past. They'll make a comment like, oh, I don't really care if it goes back to, falls 20% because I only paid this much for it. As if you haven't lost money. It's exactly. You actually have because, a week ago it was worth X and now it's worth Y. You've lost it. You haven't realized it, you haven't crystallized it, but it leads to very foggy thinking, I think, when you do that. So the yield is always appropriately calculated on the most recent price.
It's a great example, mate, because I think I often use that, not that it's, don't get back into property, but it's useful to think about housing. So I've used the example before on that kind of, I don't care if the price falls.
Yeah.
You say, okay, well, let's say you bought a house for $500,000. Let's say it's worth $1.2 million today, right? And you say, oh, I don't really care if it falls back to $100 million. I don't want that money anyway. So hang on. If you're going to sell a house, would you rather not have 1.2 than 1? Yeah, of course I would. And would you be unhappy if you knew in advance it was going to happen and you chose not to? Yeah, of course I would.
Yeah.
So that's the point, right? The house is not worth $500,000. It's worth 1.2 now. What comes next matters because you could cash out, as you say, go to cash, reinvest that money anywhere.
Yep.
And have it. The flip side is if you're happy with the running yield, then I assure you're happy to have $50 for your Commonwealth Bank shares, are you? No, I want the $100. Well, exactly. That's the point. So
yeah.
You make a very good point, mate. Very well said.
Cool.
Let's go. Oh, no. G'day, Phils. I have another inflation question for Andrew.
Oh, no.
Haha, just kidding. Oh, just got for Rick. My question today relates to the investing psychology and the feeling of making up for lost time. This is something I grapple with, as my wife and I would like the option to retire at 60. For some context, I am 45. I started investing in my early 20s. However, investing was soon put on hold as I got married, had kids, bought a home, chose to forgo a dual income, took the private school route, etc. Whilst we made choices that were not financially optimal, I wouldn't change a thing if I could do it all again. I love that. However, during those 20 years of mostly sitting on the sidelines, the market has had some great returns and possibly pulled forward some future returns. My future returns, he says, meant to make me rich. I say this in jest, but it is something I think about a lot. So my question, is worrying about depressed future returns and a feeling of making up for lost time a good or a bad thing? Should I embrace the feeling to drive me towards future goals, or am I framing this in a potentially negative light? I love this question. I love psychology questions. Mm. Full on from Rick. What do you reckon, mate?
Yeah, I think it does. I do think you don't want to think about that kind of stuff. I do think you don't want to. Yes, I said that right.
You don't want to think about that stuff. Is that what
you don't, thank you. There we go. Double negatives. you don't want to think about that stuff. I mean, yeah, you always have to have an eye on future expected return. That's what we're in the business of doing, is trying to pick something that has an attractive future investment return. But you're never going to know what it is. And as we were just sort of hinting at before, everything comes back to opportunity cost as well. So it's a question of where's the best kind of return I get. Do I want to accelerate or more strictly speaking, increase my risk to try and achieve it sooner and make up for the lost return? Definitely not. The quickest way to get poor is to try and get rich quick. It's kind of I totally get the sentiment. But as we've talked about again and again and again, the future is so unknowable and exactly how it's going to pay out that you might be right, you might be wrong. But in all cases, investing in very high quality equities is probably going to do you very well. Maybe not as well as it would have in a parallel universe where, you know, global pandemic number two, an asteroid strike didn't happen or something like that. But it's still relatively, it's always going to be pretty attractive. And unfortunately, anything you try and do to accelerate things is more often than not always, because it's a probabilistic thing, but more often than not, it's going to be counterproductive.
I think that's right. Although I'm going to make one slight exception. Rick, I absolutely agree with Andrew. Don't start trying to chase. There's a reason that throwing good money after bad is a cliche, right? Cliches are cliches because they're true. That's the point, right? They're not cliches because they're never true. No one believes them, but people say them a lot. People say them a lot because they tend to be true. Not always, but tend to be true. Throwing good money after bad is a bad idea. Trying to chase returns, taking more risk. You know, like there's a continuum between cash and number eight in the fifth at Randwick, right? And on that continuum, the more desperate you are to try and make up for lost time, effectively what you're saying is, should I take more risk and hope it works? If you end up being right, you say, see, I told you. If you end up being wrong, then you're going to work to 70 rather than 60. And mate, can I say, when you come down to that sort of question, if you have to retire at 62 rather than 60, then excuse me, take the option. If you've got to retire at 65 rather than 60, take the option. I know no one wants to work the extra 5 years. I get it. But if you've got to work to 75 because you took some risks to try and retire at 60 and got it wrong, that is just brutal. And you can't make up for lost time. One of the things, so let's say you've got 15 years of compounding left before you retire. If you get it wrong and then in 3 years' time, you've now got 12 years left. And the way compounding works, you may actually halve the amount of money you have. If you've only got 12 years rather than 15, because money doubles every 7 years if you average the market return, that 3 years you miss out on is half a double. And so you start to think about what that might look like in dollar terms. You know, you're gonna potentially have really meaningfully less money depending on how much you're starting with and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, Ram's absolutely right, with one exception. And that is, I would, if you can, to the extent you can, you may not have the potential, use that to motivate your saving, not your investing.
Yeah.
So save twice as much, or 50% more, or 20% more, or $5 more a week. If you want to make up for lost time, do it in saving dollars, and the investing dollars will go with it. But don't do it in terms of how you invest that cash, right? Invest sensibly, invest properly, invest for the long term. You're better off getting 80% of your goal than 0% of your goal, because you go too hard. You know, like any mechanical device, the harder you run it, you get increased returns for a little bit of time. You can run a machine 110% of capacity for a couple of weeks, and then it breaks down, you spend 3 months fixing it. Don't do that. So again, I can't tell you what you should do. I can't give you personal advice. So when I say don't do that, I mean no one should do that. But you get the drift. Mm. It's a tough one. Don't do it. Question from Greg, mate. This is a pointed question. This is one that he's got. I think it's a part question, part statement. My message for Scott's podcast is, he starts, I'd like to know how much influence the Motley Fool has on the market. It appears to be quite a bit. My shares in Dicker Data dropped almost 20% over 2 days, spanning last Friday to Monday this week. The ex-dividend wasn't a factor since the announcement came after that. And there seemed to be nothing else other than the fact there were at least three of your services recommended to sell or reduce. It's not often that Motley Fool give sell or hold recommendations, so this seemed significant and the market seemed to react. I'm not worried. Dicker Data has been one of my very best investments. And even this financial year, it's up about 18%. There's no way I'm selling yet just because there seems to be a mass exodus. It reminds me of Integrated Research a few years ago. I held on for some time after the sell recommendation and was the better for it. I just noticed Dicker is up 5% today. I know it's all about fear and greed and to avoid the noise, but if my suspicions are right, there's a lot of Motley Fool investors out there behaving irrationally. That's from Greg. Mate, do you have any views or do you want me to start take this one straight down the line?
Well, it's one of those things that we're starting to even notice that with. I mean, you guys are much bigger than us, but some of the small cap stocks, we can move around just because enough people act at the same time. Mm. And it's a possibility. It's just so counterproductive, though. It's just like it's equivalent of a whole bunch of people standing around and shooting themselves in the foot, like rushing for the door or the exit or the entrance, all at the same time. Yep. Yep. And I know, having worked with you guys, where there was always lots of disclaimers, please don't do this. Mm-hmm. It's not in your interest. Mm-hmm. It's actually if anyone who's into game theory, it's a phenomenally fascinating exercise in game theory. Because it's one of those things, it doesn't make any sense, but if I'm the first to act, then it actually does make sense. So people try to sort of front run things. It just leads to very poor outcomes for people. Mm. But what's interesting is, because we've been doing this for so long, mate, with you, with other people, with myself, is that it's never, even when there are things you can say, oh, that was definitely a Motley Fool recommendation, it was very noteworthy on the day, panned out and looked at it over any time frame, it's a blip on the radar. There's just no way that, and this is no insult to you guys, there's just no way that you're going to have any material influence over a share price over a long period of time by giving the most harsh criticism or the most glowing praise. Because that stuff is very, 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 very transient. So, I don't know. You'd know better than me, though. Do you think you guys have a material and lasting impact on prices? Doesn't look like it.
Sometimes, and no, in order. Sometimes we have an impact on the price. Material is an open question. What I would say is, the challenge is that let's break it back. One of the services went to hold. One of the services didn't change at all. One of the services went to sell, and that's three. It might have been a fourth one. So that there's different views across the full universe on the company in the first place. Second thing I would say is when he talks about last Friday, it was the day after the company's financial results were released, and so it's not. Is it at the same time? Yes. Could it have been related? Yeah, sure, absolutely. Mm. Very, very possible that a whole lot of Motley Fool subscribers decided to get out at the same time. Very possible. But it's the day after the results. And so to some degree, trying to separate out what did we do versus every other broker and every other research house, and every other fund manager after results were released, and they were released during the day before. So for the 2 days after that, shares fell. Okay. Make of that what you want. I have no view on because you can't know, right? You can't know. Yeah. Is it coincidental? Sorry, is it correlated? Yes, absolutely. Is it causal? I don't know. I literally can't tell you. We've had some impacts. We reckon at NIB way back in the day. Shares jumped to the point it was on the front page of the AFR. It was up 8%, but it was unusual and it was because it was thinly traded. And frankly, as a result of that, we started recommending larger companies because we wanted to make sure we didn't cause these sorts of problems. So we do our best with language, as you say, mate, and also the companies we choose. We try and be mindful of the impact we can have if we do it. Absolutely. Is it possible? Yes. Is it probable? Maybe yes. I don't know. I mean, the number of members times the number of shares they own times the number who took a decision to make a sell. I mean, you didn't, Greg, so maybe some held as well. This one is probably a really I'll say a bad example. I don't mean that as a criticism of you. But I think it's a tough example because literally results are out the day before. Mm. So it's kind of like, you know, if you look at the whole market of activity based on a very, very significantly market sensitive announcement and bit of information and say, well, the Motley Fool sold. For all I know, Goldman Sachs might have sold a massive stake on behalf of some pension fund in the US, right? It could have been five times the size of the impact that we had on the market, if any. Or not. We might have been the entire impact. I just don't know.
Mm. Yeah, it's one of those things that it's really, it just feels important. And this is not just a question of you guys. Exactly. Just it happens all the time. Whether it's a short sell report or something, some entity will come out with an opinion that is influential and will drive things.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
it feels really important and big, but it never does. It's never lasting. It's sort of, and as I say, for a lot of the people that try to. Gain that in a way, it can really explode in your face really badly too. Particularly some of these liquid stocks. Well, I'm just going to buy before everyone else does. And people are buying at any kind of price. And but they fail to realize that you have the same kind of problem. You've got to be early and right on both the way in and the way out. And it can be very difficult. For some stocks that might only trade $10,000 or $20,000 worth a day, doesn't take a lot of people to really throw that around. You can find yourself trapped in a fairly illiquid stock at a very unappealing price because you tried to sort of game this thing. And
that's true, actually.
You know, if there was any legitimacy to that sort of strategy, I've not seen it work.
by the way, if you could have bought Woolies for $2 and it jumped to $2.20 on the day of the IPO and now it's $40, you tell me whether you'd rather have missed out or not. I mean, would you rather buy for $2 than $2.20? Of course you would. But if you can get $2.20 to $40, is that not more important than trying to get from 220 to 232 and then sell, or you know, miss out because you paid too much for the stock? If we're half right most of the time, I said this team only last week. We're talking about limit orders, and I said my personal view, both on my behalf and behalf of our members, is I would rather, if given the choice of two bad options, I'd rather members pay a little bit. If we're right more often than not, and we tend to be, I'd rather pay a little bit more than not buy at all.
Yep.
You know, Warren Buffett said he lost. $6 billion, because he argued the price of Walmart shares and he missed out by an eighth of a cent or something ridiculous, whatever it was. He said, "I'm going to pay this." The seller said, "No, I want that." Buffett said, "No, get stuffed." And it was he's called it a $6 billion mistake, because he should have paid a little bit more for a business that was growing that's going to be worth a heap more in future, rather than nickel and diming the very, very last cent.
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
I mean, I hate the fact the price has moved. We tell our members over and over again, please don't do it. And frankly, it's not just us; it's other people in the market as well. I have used a limit order maybe twice in my life. I will buy shares that are roughly decent value because I think they're going to be worth much more in the future. I can't remember not buying a share because it was 1101 rather than 1099, and I set myself a hard price of some maximum I would otherwise pay. Just go with it.
I really double down on that idea. It's sort of like it is if you like dicker data. And it's at 1308. You know, whether you buy it at 1350, 12, in the fullness of time is just so inconsequential. It makes no difference whatsoever. I'm with you, Matt. I'll use limit orders when there are liquidity issues at play and I'm not in a rush. But otherwise, you just put the bloody order through. It's not going to make any difference whatsoever. It's really nickel and diming kind of things that just shouldn't be part of your focus.
There's no harm in using limit order, by the way, but trying to do it and then missing out because you didn't get the price you wanted is just look. If you're buying an infrastructure stock and the range of outcomes is tiny and you want to get the absolute right price because the growth is going to be 2% a year, then price does matter a lot. Don't get me wrong. But if you're buying a company that's like a dicker, that you're not buying dicker for income probably, and you're not buying it because you expect it to be this no growth stock, right? Greg, sounds like you like the company. I think it's great. I like the company too.
Well, I'll give you a good example. Throw you guys a free pass. I remember being with the Fool years ago and Matt and Joe ran the Motley Fool Pro real life portfolio, and the trading rules were they had to release the next trade to all of the members, and almost always the price would go up because everyone piles into it, and then the fund itself had to buy. So it was, you know, it really sort of, I could see Matt and Joe's the difficulty with that. It's because so we have to signal in advance what we're going to buy and as a result pay a higher price for it. But the Fool did it because it was the right thing to do. And you know what? The pro performed really, really well. Like, it, you know, it didn't make a difference. It didn't make a difference is my point. Would it have made a difference? Yeah, overall it would have at the edges, but I mean, it's just, it's not the main factor to worry about. Generally right as opposed to specifically wrong is what counts.
Good point. All right. Thank you for listening, Fools. We appreciate you spending some time with us, spending an hour or so in our company. We certainly enjoy doing the podcast for you. If you want more from Andrew, and you should, go to strawman.com, check out what Strawman has to offer. And of course, follow Andrew on the socials. Sage_Simeon is his Twitter handle. That's Sage, S-A-G-E underscore Simeon. Or at Strawman Invest. They're the two ways you can get hold of Andrew and of strawman.com. Or you can follow me on Twitter and Insta at TMF Scott P. Same handle for both. The Motley Fool's handle on both is the same, at The Motley Fool AU. You can jump on Facebook at slash Scott Phillips Money. The Motley Fool is / The Motley Fool Australia. We have a YouTube channel. We have another podcast, The Good Oil with Scott Phillips. I would appreciate it if you wouldn't mind checking it out, because it basically makes me feel better. And no one likes to have their podcast cancelled. So do me a favour if you wouldn't mind. Follow that particular podcast.
Yeah, check it out. It's
in the meantime,
good.
And until next Friday, Fool on.
See you later.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services Licence 400691. Listener.